is Maggie, and for tonight's Positude Powwow, I have as a returning guest author and reporter Cheryl Costa and her partner, Linda Costa, who was also a co-author of her book. Hi, can you both hear me?
Yes.
How are you? So we were talking last time, Cheryl, about some of the experiences that people had shared with you, and we really wanted to go into more about your book, but we ran out of time. So let's talk about the title of your book. How did you get the concept for this book? And we'll just take it from there. How does that sound?
That sounds fine to me.
Okay.
Let's let Linda give you the title and the concept behind the book.
Sure.
The title of the book is UFO Sightings Desk Reference, United States
of America,
2001 to 2015. Called it a desk reference book because I'm a librarian. In fact, I'm a cataloging librarian right now. And reference books are a special category of literature that always means it's serious and that it's meant to be referred to as opposed to sat down and read through like a typical UFO studies book. The idea is it would be evergreen. Since it hadn't been done before, we were covering a period and an idea that was new. And the hope was that people and libraries would buy this and put it on their reference shelves. And it would become and I think it has become a standard in the field now.
That's what I understand anyway. Now, what kind of statistics specifically do you represent in your book?
The statistics are reports of sightings. These are people that have filled out sighting reports in either the MUFON database or the New Fork database. And so it's self-reported. They fill out a long form, where, when, what they saw, et cetera. Unfortunately, and as a librarian, I really regret this, there is no official place that you can get UFO sightings information. The usual places that you go for scientific information, like the government or scientific institutions, are not touching this subject for various reasons. And so all that we have to go on is these databases have been created by citizen researchers as at MUFON and New Fork, and then ordinary citizens that decide that they've had this experience and it's so important and it was such a astounding thing for them that they had to tell someone. And fortunately, these databases are available for people to report what they see.
Perfect. Now, for those who are not in the UFO field, would you mind determining or at least defining what MUFON and New Fork are?
MUFON is the Mutual UFO Network. It was formed in 1969. That's when Project Blue Book and the U.S. government decided that they were no longer officially interested in UFO sightings.
Doing the Air Force's job since 1969.
Yeah, they have a great T-shirt that has that on it. New Fork is out in California, and I must admit, I'm not sure when they were founded.
National UFO Reporting Center. And I'm not 100% sure. I think it's in like the early 2000s, like 2001, 2002.
The New Fork database is actually the larger of the two databases. And what Cheryl and I did in this book for the first time was to combine the information from these two different databases. And they were somewhat friendly, but there were some fields that had to be manipulated, et cetera. But this is the first time that anybody has compiled this data together and put it in, did an analysis and made it available for researchers and others to use.
That's amazing. Somewhat friendly. I like that. Now, we talked last time with Cheryl about some of her favorite stories that were relayed to her. Have you got some favorite stories that you'd like to share?
You mean as in UFO sightings or?
Yes, absolutely. As in, you know, things that people had reported to you or things that you came up with when you were doing your research.
How about that one you were telling me at supper?
The environmental epidemiology?
No, the guys in the boat.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and back before I moved out of the area, so this was back in about 1975-ish era, I had my best friend had a twin brother, and he and his buddy had gone out fishing on Lake Erie at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and they saw a saucer rise up and take out off over the lake. and he went to report it into the to the Air Force. I think it was the Air Force or the NASA. I wasn't sure which. There is a NASA facility at Cleveland, so I'm not sure which one he went to. But whoever he talked to told him not to talk about it anymore. And he was a reliable witness because he had just gotten out of the Navy and had been working on an aircraft carrier. So he knew what the latest technology looked like. And, you know, he was sure that it was not anything that we had. That was my first exposure to someone I knew seeing one, and also actually my first exposure to sort of the government suppressing the information. And I was somewhat of a hippie back then, and I had a question of authority and, you know, impeach Nixon bumper sticker on my car. So that sort of resonated with me, that you can't always trust what the government says.
Right, exactly. And I'm sure that you hear that a lot in the people that come forward with your stories, because, well, let's approach it that way. How many of your stories would you say in the compilation of your book involve people that were involved with the military or were, let's say, a veteran?
We have no way of determining that. Remember, these are all self-reports. And in some cases, what was it, something like 4% people were even afraid to put down where they lived or where they saw it. You know, okay, I took like a class in library science school, and, you know, when I was getting my master's degree, on government information. Now you can imagine this was not the most stimulating of classes, but it was very informative as to how to find information in the government. And one of the most important things I learned was that they tell you is that just because you want a statistic doesn't mean that the statistic exists. Which is something what we found is that there were no statistics that we could get a hold of. So that's why we sort of created this statistic. And also, you know, when you get scientific information, you have to evaluate the credibility of where it came from. So mostly things like statistics you get from the Census Department, which is part of the Department of Commerce. And, you know, they may be tracking these things, but they're certainly not sharing it with us. So.
Maggie, one of the things you need to keep in mind, and I think it's important to have Linda explain this, of how the book came to be from the standpoint that we went after statistics and we went after the idea of clusters. And I think this is very important for your listeners to know.
Absolutely.
Well, during the 1980s, after I'd moved to Washington, D.C. area, I got a job at the National Academy of Sciences, which is also called the National Research Council. And this is a quasi-governmental organization that was originally set up by President Abraham Lincoln back during the Civil War. And what it was a mechanism for top scientists in the United States to offer their services for free. These are volunteers to provide the government with their scientific expertise to look at usually controversial or very difficult scientific issues. And so what they would do is that there would be something that would come up that like the government institution, it was too controversial and they didn't want to touch it. And so they would give it to the National Academy of Sciences. Because it was a private institution, they were not subject to the Sunshine Laws, which requires government meetings to allow the public in and the press, et cetera. So they could have these secret meetings of the top scientists, and they would look at different issues. Well, this was during the when the environmental studies was really starting to take off. You know, President Nixon founded the EPA in 1970, and after 10, 15 years, there were still a lot of problems that they were trying to figure out how to approach. And I worked on this book called Environmental Epidemiology. And epidemiology, as probably people know, is you sort of the study of diseases. You know, you look at, you know, where there's like, you know, where there's measles and clusters of diseases to try to figure out where they're coming from or, you know, et cetera. Well, they came up with the idea of using, that they knew that certain toxic chemicals would make people and usually children sick. And so they decided to use the idea of using epidemiology, which had been traditionally used with diseases, to look at children that were getting sick, like rare leukemias that could be caused by toxic chemicals. And so they would start looking for the sick children. and they would find, look for clusters of children that were sick with these particular rare diseases. And then they would start looking for toxic chemicals nearby to see if perhaps that's what was causing the kids to get sick. And so that's sort of, you know, Love Canal here in New York, was that was one of the first environmental epidemiology cases. And there was another one up in Woburn, Massachusetts, where kids were getting leukemia, and it turned out there was a contaminated well that was making everybody sick. Well, so with the UFO studies, and this is a theory I've sort of been developing, is that UFO studies are sort of where environmental studies were 20, 30, 40 years ago. And in that, we've mostly, because the official scientific institutions such as the government or you know, National Academy of Sciences too, for that matter, are not officially looking at these things, that so it's been done by unofficial channels, like people like MUFON and New Fork, and individual researchers like Stan Friedman and Donaldson, et cetera. And, but they've mostly been working with anecdotal information, you know, people telling their stories of the sightings they've seen, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, anecdotal information and eyewitnesses are, they're a good way to point, but it's not a scientific method. And for UFOlogy to be considered a scientific research, it's got to start using more scientific methods. And we live in the age of big data where, you know, our companies and retailers, everybody's looking at data, and the whole thing with, you know, Facebook and Google and statistics, instead of them taking your, that's so they can get the data and crunch it to find out, you know, how they can sell you this, you know, peanut butter spreader better than somebody else. So the same thing with UFOs is that we really want to advance the field and start looking at the problems in a different way, using the statistics as the way to go. And these statistics were, this information was trapped in these two different databases that didn't talk to each other. And so Cheryl did the, she worked crunchy at a bank for a while and learned really good statistic crunchy, number crunchy skills. So she put them together and created our own database, which has, that can talk with both of them. And we're able to, by doing the, breaking it down by states and by shapes, et cetera.
Counties.
And we're working on cities right now. For the first time, we're making available to the UFO community that kind of data that the environmental community was just given back in the 1980s. So I think it's exciting.
We were just at the MUFON Symposium in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And one of the things Linda and I did was we got them to donate a table to us. And we sat in the lobby with a computer and a small printer. And if somebody would give us their home state and their home county, we pushed a couple of buttons and a printout would come out with all of the sighting information for their home county in numbers and city breakdown. So if you're in a particular county A and these 12 cities had UFO sightings over the last 17 years, it printed out what city it was and how many sightings they had in that city. It was well received.
That's amazing. Wow, I'm sure it was. How long did it take you to write this book?
I think we figured it out was about 18 months. First was we're sort of waiting until the end of the year so we could get the end of the year data. And then once it was downloaded,
we developed some process.
Yeah,
too.
Cheryl did the crunching. I worked on formatting the book and also writing the, trying to figure out how to convey questions that people would have about the data, you know, what kind of introduction to do. And I thought, well, people are used to using FAQs on websites. And so while it's sort of unusual to put an FAQ in a print or a regular book, I thought that that would be something that people that are used to digital information would be able to relate to. So we came up with the FAQ questions, most of them serious and a couple snarky ones. Yeah, you know.
The snarkiest of the questions was people ask us whether or not we have tinfoil hats. We said no, but we do have some nice fedoras.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question, was what was the snark question?
Yeah, yeah.
That's classic.
Well, I have a wicked sense of humor I inherited from my father. So, you know, I'm always, it's, I guess, you know, I've been working in scientific information for 30 years now. And I mean, I've worked with, you know, really, I mean, Nobel you know, winners and top scientists at the Environmental Protection Agency. And, you know, it's just people need to respect science more. And I think in UFOlogy, it's even harder because there's already that ridicule factor that people have been, the propaganda from the CIA, et cetera, over the years to as a way of controlling people's interest in it. So, well, the way to keep people from asking uneasy questions is to make fun of them for doing so. That's how you suppress information. And as a librarian, when I graduated, one of the things we sort of take a vow is to fight censorship and anywhere we find it. And so for me, this is really an ethical work on my part, and that, you know, this UFO information, we don't, like we say in the book, we don't claim we know who's driving these things, but there is still value in the information of how many people are seeing these things. I mean,
sure.
Yeah, people don't report stuff like this unless it really has affected them. And I think that's something as women, perhaps, I know that it's sort of strange that the women are the ones that brought out the scientific, you know, statistics. And neither one of us is real great at statistics. We've had to learn as we go. But it's, to me, as my undergraduate degrees in psychology, that I'm interested in, that, you know, this, people really have to be driven. This had to really be important to somebody. It really had to affect them, what they see, and that it is wrong ethically and morally for our government and governments and officials and the powers that be to ignore that these people are seeing things. And I mean, we were told after, I mean, I lived in Washington. I worked, you know, half a block literally from the White House during 9/11. And, you know, actually I had stayed home that day to get my hair done. So I wasn't downtown when it hit. So, which was one of those lucky things, I guess. But, you know, this needs to be taken seriously. And, you know, the people
that you live near Washington, yeah. Not so much the 9/11.
yeah. Well, we left Washington. We're in Syracuse now. So, but it was an interesting experience there. And, you know, I learned a lot about how the government works. And I mean, I was a contractor always. I never actually was a federal employee, but, you know, I've seen enough behind the scenes, including in top, you know, in science. Science has politics, just like every other organization or field. And, you know, I think we've been told that if we see something, to say something. Okay, so we're supposed to report the backpack that somebody abandoned, but we're not supposed to, that some saucer flying over our heads. You know, it doesn't make sense. And it's really the hypocrisy and the lying that says that, oh, well, yes, the backpack's important, but the flying saucer going over your head isn't. I mean, that's just illogical. I'm sorry.
Absolutely. In fact, I don't know how you feel about going down this rabbit hole, but some of the interviews that I do are exposing of governmental conspiracies and where the government has tried to squelch people for various reasons. I've done interview with Christine Gilberti, whose husband Joe discovered a well in Florida. He had done some work on a farmer's farm, and the farmer had a well that he eventually sold to Joe, in which the pH levels of this water were absolutely off the charts. No one had ever seen anything like it. Mm-hmm. And they had tried to develop this well. What they wanted to do was pipeline it free to all of the residents of Florida, at least to start. And he's in jail right now. He's been there since, I think, April 8th. He's been arrested several times, a couple of times without any proper documentation or warrant, and placed in prison repeatedly for his efforts in just trying to bring this pure water for free to the citizens. And one of the people that was involved in the initial work with him actually they think that he was gotten too, and became scared. And he sent Joe a text at one point. Joe, it's all about Nestle. So I do shows about stuff like that quite often, and I can certainly relate to how the government covers things up and ignores things. I mean, we can go even down the chemtrails. I don't know how you both feel about those, but, you know, that's another thing that people are getting sick from, immunizations. You know, we could take it down any road we want. And it's very obvious to at least people in my type of circle that so much of this corruption not only exists, but is swept under the carpet. It's just very, very disturbing, to say the least.
Well, one thing that people need to understand is somebody who worked in D.C. for 35 years, that there's layers, okay? So you have the elected officials and the executive branch, and they appoint people to be ahead of these agencies and things, okay? And then the next level down are the federal bureaucrats. These are people that are federal employees. They have, they're paid fairly decently. To fire a federal employee, they can appeal to like 5 different places before you can get rid of them. So they're really hard to remove. But that's on purpose in a way. It's because the idea is that they don't want, that you need to have somebody that's not as easily pushed around by the appointees, okay? And then the next level down are the contractors.
Yeah.
And I was always a contractor, and so was Cheryl. You know, the contractors are the ones they hire to do a lot of the actual work. I mean, like I was hired to run the library at the toxicology library at the Environmental Protection Agency. And I would work for private industry. I called myself a capitalist pig librarian. So it's fairly unusual. most librarians work for public libraries or, you know, colleges, et cetera. And so we were there to make money by doing this contract. And we would then take our sort of our what we wanted to do, we were supposed to do from the federal bureaucrats who then were influenced by the agency. But when it came to like answering the phones or dealing with the public, it was always the contractor, you see, because the feds didn't want to deal directly to the public. And so you've got these three levels, and in some ways they act as a check and balance. I had a couple times I was pressured as a contractor to change something on an electronic document that was on an EPA website. And I said, okay, we can change it, but we have to put a notice in it that it's been changed. Well, no, can't you just go in and change it? And I said, no. And in fact, I was hauled in with a higher level EPA person, and they tried to twist my arm to do it. And I said, no, you know, I mean, you can get me fired if you want, but I'm not going to do that because it is ethically wrong. And so you've got all these, you know, part of the thing about conspiracies is that to a certain extent, I feel that most government agencies and offices are not coordinated enough to carry on a good conspiracy.
They're not smart enough.
They're not smart enough, yeah. You know, so I think that the people overestimate the ability to have a coordinated conspiracy because you've got a lot of people that all have different agendas. The contractors are there to make money. The feds are there to keep their nice jobs and you know, do the work that they were hired to do. And then the federal appointees are there to do what, you know, the marching orders they get from the White House and to further their political career. And all the bureaucrats are also interested after they retire with their nice pension, they'll go work as a contractor or a consultant. So, you know, so they want to make the contacts with the industries and the things that they're regulating, so when they retire, they can then get a nice contracting job or a consulting job. So I think that people that are into conspiracies, I think you have to keep in mind that that requires a lot of effort and coordination, and you know, human beings just don't do that easily. There are conspiracies, I'm sure, but I wouldn't overestimate, you know, the ability for the government to carry out a good conspiracy. But also, I do want to emphasize that there were a lot, like at EPA, there were a lot of really good, conscientious, ethical, moral scientists that really wanted to protect the environment and protect people. And they were not allowed to because, like, regulating the water to the level that it would be safe, it would cost too much to clean it up. And the government, the state governments, and the local governments, et cetera, didn't want to pay the money. And neither did the citizens. They didn't want to pay the taxes necessary to build a state-of-the-art water treatment plant. You know, so everybody's got a little responsibility for it, not just the government, but also the people that are not necessarily willing to pay. They complain about their taxes and they don't want to pay for government, and yet they want government to regulate and make things better for them. So you can't have it both ways. You know, everybody's got a responsibility. As to chemtrails and that kind of thing, I really don't know that much about it. I do know there's a lot of polluted water out there. That I know.
Now, one thing, I was talking with Louis Alessandro, who was the guy who ran the Pentagon program for studying UFOs. There, that was all publicized back in December of last year. And one of the conversations we got into, me having been a contractor and working very close with the government and working with him, and we got discussing the fact that there is, while he had the authority to go in and access just about every program that had anything to do with UFOs all the way back to like 1947, and he told me, yes, he was able to pick open every one of those compartmented secret groups. The problem was he able to get to all of them? And it really came down to less conspiracy and more of a case of bad cataloging and bad information management is what it comes down to. Okay. So, you know, if somebody does an investigation and then they toss it, they don't think much of it, and they toss it over to a secretary and say, file this, it could get filed under anything. And a lot of things have probably been lost and lost in plain sight because it was simply badly filed. Look, a couple of years ago, NASA said they lost all the tapes to the moon landings and things. Okay. They have terrible archiving processes in that organization. Linda can talk to that. She worked at Goddard for a short time.
Yeah.
Well, before we do that, why don't we take a quick break? And okay. Then we'll jump right back into that. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
Okay. Stay with me. We'll be back in just a moment.
Put yourself in my place. Put yourself in my place. Going to the river to see my cousin John. Going down in the water, rise up again. Down in the water, rise up again. Spirit come down, light shining on my face. Light shining on my face. Put yourself in my place. Yourself in my place. All over the world, people crying out in pain. I see my sister persecuted. Oh Martha, don't you cry no more. See my brother suffering. Oh Lazarus, won't you come for? Poor and the hungry, wanna be fed. Sick and the lame, just wanna be led. All over the world, people cry out in pain. People cry out in pain. This cup for me. If it be your will, pass this cup for me. Put yourself in my place. Trying to tell Peter, James, and John about tearing down the temple and raising it up again. Soldiers coming after me. Oh, Peter, why deny me? Soldiers gonna put me on the tree. Why have you forsaken me? Beat me down, pierce my skin. Death can't ever do me in. Blood in the water to make everybody free. make everybody free.
The music that you just heard was from my buddy Pat Carr. Please support his music. You can check him out on SoundClick or Pat Carr at pwcarrmusic.com. So continuing our conversation, go ahead with your statement that you started before the break, if you would, please.
Well, I think what Cheryl was talking about is that in as a librarian, I know a lot of people that, oh, librarians, we don't need librarians anymore. We got Google. Well, you know, librarians, I mean, we go to graduate school and we learn how to find information and how different disciplines organize their information, how they do their research, where they publish, et cetera. And while that can be automated to a certain extent, it's still dependent on whoever is generating the information puts it somewhere in a logical manner. Like she was saying about the thing Alessandra said, is that, you know, literally, if you can't find the file, it might as well not exist. And I think that we've all had that experience where we know we had something, but we can't find it. My mother used to call that putting it in a safe place. Yeah. Well, you know, the government's the same way. I mean, you know, if you remember the Raiders of the Lost Ark, remember that last scene where they're putting the Ark in this huge warehouse? Well, you know, yeah. I lived a couple miles from that warehouse. It really does exist, and they really do file stuff like that. And it just, if you can't, and if it wasn't classified and coded properly, it's gone. You know, and like in the case of the NASA tapes, you know, they were looking for these tapes. And actually what happened is they allowed somebody to borrow them that used to work there. And that person never brought them back and nobody followed up to find out that they brought them back, et cetera. So they're gone, you know.
That's disturbing.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, it's just so it.
A lot with the UFO community, the UFO side of it comes into this. Remember, when Project Blue Book was closed, the only thing that really closed was the public side of it, being able to call the Air Force and tell them you had a sighting. They stopped collecting that information. They collected over 12,000 of them. But the program went dark. It was dark, it was secret, and they did monitor it, okay? They did monitor this stuff. But if you call, the average citizen called up an Air Force base and told them, hey, we just saw something really unusual, they will tell you, we have not collected this information since 1969. Please call your local fire department or police department. That was their stock line.
Isn't that a conspiracy, though? I mean, wouldn't you consider that a conspiracy?
Well, yeah.
Policy. It was a conspiracy of policy.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But wow. we don't know who was doing it, you know,
and
you know, like Richard Dolan's written some real great things about that. And, you know, my favorite one is this, you know, we're older and I don't know if your listeners or you remember the Weekly World News. Yeah, it was one of those like Inquirer, like pulp paper, you know. Well, it turns out that whole thing was funded by the CIA, And if you remember the pictures of, you know, the aliens, Hillary's having the alien baby and stuff. See, that was all, that was part of the campaign to make fun of UFOs. There were always a lot of alien stories in there, if you remember. Almost every week there was something ridiculous, you know, Elvis and the aliens and, you know, et cetera. And that was part of their campaign to get people to no longer take this seriously. And, you know, and for that matter, even when the Condon report, when they closed the government official interest in it, they didn't say they didn't exist. They just said that the government does not perceive them to be a threat and so therefore no one wants to invest no more money in them. Well, you know, what does that mean? That means is, well, we're still going to follow them, but we don't think it is the threat and we're trying to calm down the public. And remember, this is after the Vietnam War and the protests and the, you know, the feminism and, you know, the whole country is in upheaval and they needed to, they wanted to calm things down.
You know, Maggie, one thing you need to keep in mind, and I think Linda can explain this better than anybody, people from the first column I wrote 5 years ago to something I wrote about a week ago, somebody dropped me back, some troll would drop me back a line and said, you got no proof. Well, Linda can tell you about proof.
Well, before we go into that, what's the word I want to say? The discrediting of the people, mm-hmm. whether it be for UFOs, I have to believe that is a big way for the government to cover up anything that they want to hide. It's just by making a mockery of it, putting out false news stories that discredit U.S. News and World Report. And boy, the Inquirer and all of those used to carry stories like that too, the alien crashes.
Maggie, a thing you got to keep in mind, though, remember, most of the information, Kate, in any court in this country, an eyewitness account can get you convicted. Okay, and the only protection that they have to defend you in that court of law against that eyewitness is to find some way to discredit that witness. Okay, so what do we have? We have, based on our book, we had 121,000 eyewitness accounts over a period of 15 years. Now, that should be good for any court in the country, but what did people have to do? They had to do the CIA had to do a big psyop to discredit anybody who reports one of these things as a kook or a nut or deranged. That was the whole mentality. That was their way of discrediting people, okay, and discrediting the witnesses, though they may have, honest to goodness, seen something amazing. They got to discredit them so they can't be taken seriously. And that's a big deal. Now, there's another issue about validation. You know, validation is done by scientific organizations. Well, did you say that?
Mm-hmm.
All four of them?
Yep.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
This is a little bit more philosophical. But you know, one of the things over the years is that I've learned and from the scientists is that, you know, they're concerned about people not thinking rigorously. Also, you know, how is it that you can get ridicule to work? Well, the way you get it to work is you get people to think that they should be evaluated and judged and that other people have the right to judge them. And, you know, so it's really this is really sort of a philosophical, social, psychological, moral problem, and that people have gotten increasingly afraid that, well, they have to be normal, and that what if people don't think they're normal, and what will the people say? And the social media has just increased it because now you have the whole world that can say that you're crazy. And I think it's really, how do we strengthen people's self-worth? I mean, we've had people ask, well, how can you do this? Aren't you afraid people are going to say you're crazy? Well, you know, like I said, I used to be a hippie. I left that a long time ago. I was raised to think for myself and to you know, and decide what's important and what's its right, and know that I have the right to hold to my values and decisions, and that somebody else thinking I'm wrong, if I, you know, that it's really not that important until you get to the point where you're breaking laws, et cetera. But even that, sometimes, you know, you have to break the law. I mean, we were found, my people have been in America since before 1750. I mean, we've been here a long time. And it's like, you know, we're a country of rebels. We're the people that threw the tea into, and I'm not a tea partier, but the tea into the, the Boston Harbor, you know. It's just, you know, if the government is wrong, or if somebody in, you know, question authority, if somebody is wrong, she said, well, because I'm the government, or I make more money than you, and so therefore I know more. No, I'm sorry. It doesn't work that way. You know, we're not rolling the dough by any means, but I know I have a good brain, and I've used it, and I will continue to use it. And I think that, like, the UFO studies is important. I think that knowing the statistics and trying to approach this for another way to get people's attention, but we're against this whole dumbing down of, well, I don't believe in science, or I don't believe in this. You know, it's a fact or it isn't. And, well, I don't believe in UFOs. This is not a religion or a spiritual thing. I meant, when I went to look for, I cataloged the book, okay, so it would be available for people. And I went to look for the Library of Congress subject heading. That's what you put down, that, you know, it's like fiction or it's American history or whatever, you know. And you know what, you know what UFOs are classified under? Aviation.
I wouldn't. Oh, interesting.
Which is under motor vehicles. So UFOs are a type of flying a motorized vehicle. That's how the Library of Congress classifies it.
Well, now, absolutely.
Not under religion.
No. The decline in critical and independent thinking over the course of the past several years, and just looking at the youth today, the way that we were raised, as you were stating earlier, you know, the ability to think independently, the ability to critically take this information and determine for yourself, is this real? Is this a fallacy? And then furthermore, to be able to investigate and research to satisfy your own questioning in your own mind. I just, unfortunately, I don't believe that exists for the majority of America's youth nowadays. It doesn't. And that's a very sad statement for our society as a whole. But I'm in total agreement with you on that. I want to ask you a quick question. Oh, did you want to say something? Go ahead, Linda.
No, that was Cheryl. That was
you know, when we were writing the book over that 18-month period, we were constantly back and forth talking about how do we present certain things. Not so much how you graph it out or something like that, but how do you present certain things? We were breaking new ground here. We're trying to explain the sightings more than just, you know, a lot of numbers. There was a chart that we had done experimentally. It was UFOs by month. And a number, when I had showed it around to some of the UFO researchers here in New York State, they thought it was a rather dumb chart. You know, who cares about what month the UFOs were seen in? Well, actually, as it turned out, we found that we made a major discovery by plotting that graph. Because when we did it for all 50 states, one day Linda's putting the book together and she noticed that there's a difference depending upon what latitude the state is at. So if you're in a northern latitude, all the peak sightings are in like June, July, August, that type of thing. If you move down south, that peak moves down and the sightings seem to flatten out. And when you get down to the deep south, the sightings are pretty much statistically flat all year long. Nobody knew that before. Nobody knew that Saturday night is the hot night for UFO sightings. Nobody knew.
Yeah, but you have to be careful that you don't conflate the sightings with the existence of a vehicle or a UFO, et cetera. So, you know, it's I personally, you know, what I've been struck by is that I think the truth or the secrets to this whole UFO thing is in the shapes, you know. And I was putting together the book and I'm looking, I mean, our list of shapes is what, some like
about 35 or 40,
about 35 different shapes. Okay. You go out there and look at a parking lot and like most of the cars look the same. Okay. You know, as human beings, we don't have a lot of variety in the vehicles we drive. Except when we perhaps go to another country, like we went to Italy and we noticed they had all these little tiny cars. I mean, they could park them sideways. They were incredibly small. And there was a difference, but, you know, it was a different country and they had a different shape of cars. But in general, there's not a wide variety. But when you start looking at all these UFOs that people are seeing, I mean, you know, you've got the spheres, you've got the flying saucers, you've got the egg-shaped, you've got the cube, the Borg cubes, as I call them. You know, those are the ones that I'm not a fond of. You know, it's a, and also the peak that they seem to peak every 7 years, and in the amount. And I joked with Cheryl, it's like, well, everybody's got to go back and get the latest model spaceship, you know, so the trade-in value is about every 7 years, you know. And that's like, why are some shapes, you know, disappear and other ones come in? Well, you know, the models change and somebody wants the new sporty egg shape. They're tired of the saucer, you know. So, but then again, it just might be that maybe these are, if they are from alien races or interdimensional races, whatever, they all have different vehicles. And is it because the vehicle's different because maybe the creatures inside them are different and have different ways of controlling the vehicles? And that's what fascinates me, is the diversity, of the UFO shapes and the diversity, potential diversity of the entities that are in them and how they operate. And, you know, why is it that somebody has an orange thing that sort of glows and somebody else is driving something that basically looks like a car without wheels, you know? So it's, I think that's fascinating. And I haven't seen a lot of interest in that. And that's why we're working on this right now. The desk reference we used as a subtitle, Unidentified Flying Objects, Frequency, Distribution, Shapes. And right now, we'll probably, our next book that will come out will probably address the shapes, because to me, that's something that really needs to be looked at, as to in different shapes at different places in the country, is because they have different functions. You know, so to me, that is really interesting.
Maggie, you were going to ask a question?
Basically, I mean, it's gone so quickly. Thank you both so much for coming on tonight. If you'd like to go ahead and promote your website, your information, and if you have a closing statement, that would be wonderful.
Well, the name of the book is UFO Sightings Desk Reference, United States of America, 2001 to 2015, by Cheryl Costa and Linda Miller Costa. The easiest way to get it is go on Amazon. They'll get it out to you quickly. Cheryl's website, she writes a column, New York Skies, for SyracuseNewTimes.com. You can find that's over 5 years, and they're very varied, from statistical columns to anecdotes about sightings in the area, political disclosure, conspiracy theories, abductees, experiencers, etc.
Just about everything in the UFO discussion.
Yeah, and her column's been, you know, shared on places as diverse as Fox News to, we had an article in the New York Times when the book came out, and so we've gotten a lot of exposure, but we didn't do it for the exposure. We did it because we felt that it was important, and that myself as a scientist, I really wanted to get a new way of looking at UFO studies out there, and I think we have succeeded in doing that. And this is my first radio show, so.
I'm thrilled that you were able to join us. That's wonderful.
I hope I did okay.
Oh, you did absolutely amazing. Are you kidding me? And I love your sense of humor, by the way. Thank you. Thank you both for joining me tonight. And I really, again, appreciate this. And, you know, there's always potential to have you both back on in the future if you're interested.
Sure. It's been a great experience.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, and have a good evening. So there's another positive powwow regarding UFO phenomena. I hope to be able to bring you a couple of more shows in the future regarding this topic. And I've been blessed to have a somewhat diverse group of people with different viewpoints. And regardless of whether or not they are in alignment with my personal beliefs, I always find that there's so much to learn. It's wonderful to be able to hear different people's perspectives and points of view. And I always come away from every single interview with new knowledge, which is amazing. Several weeks after doing this interview, today, in fact, was able to attend a CNY UFO meeting. If you haven't joined their Facebook group, please do so. It's a wonderful group, I have to say. I went in today. I wasn't able to stay for the duration because I had a previous personal engagement, but they were watching the Travis Walton movie, and it was very interesting to me. And I thought that the movie was not only very well done, but the attitude when I walked into the room was very friendly and welcoming and inviting. I believe Cheryl does run that group. The group seemed to be non-judgmental. If you have had an experience like this and you just want to hear maybe other people's stories, even if you don't want to talk about yours, I would encourage you to attend one of those meetings and see what they have to offer. I have many friends who claim to have had this type of experience. Some are willing to talk about it privately, but do not want to record it. And I can understand that. And then I have some other friends who are terrified to talk about it because it brings up personal memories that are very upsetting to them. And I can understand that too. I know how it feels to share personal experiences with someone, especially someone that you trust, and then have that trust betrayed. It happens to the best of us. But what we need to remember in a case like that is, even if someone seems empathetic or in agreement with you when you're speaking, and yeah, I'm all about that, and then, you know, the next week they turn around and take a whole 360 degree approach with whoever they're speaking with and, you know, mock and bash what you had to share with them. What we need to remember in a situation like that is it's not a reflection on you. It's a reflection of their lack of integrity and their lack of honesty as a person. And then you kind of have to examine their motives. You know, why are they doing that? If it's in a public forum, is it for ratings? Is it to incite other people? Is it to be on the right side or what they think is the right side of the fence? I don't know. I don't play those games, so I couldn't tell you. What I can tell you is, if you've had an experience like this, find somebody to talk to. I think it's important that you try and at least share, if you're able to, what you've been through. They may have some information for you that is a vital piece of the puzzle that you've been looking for to help it all come together for you. I think the courageous ones are the ones who come forward and share their knowledge, regardless of whether they think they will be mocked or perceived in a different light. Regardless of your personal situation, there's always someone to talk to that you can trust. And if you have a lack of people in your circle that you do trust, you can always email me. I always have an empathetic ear to someone who's suffering from, whether it be an experience with this or any. Stand firm in what you believe in. Please support L&M Radio Network. We are listener funded, and we do rely on your donations to continue to bring you these broadcasts. I will see you next week with another episode of the Positude Podcast. Thank you all. God bless you, and have a good night.